Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 69 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the novelist Jane Fever speaks with Julia Coppice about her novel An Inventory of Heaven, which, in its exploration of tragedy and darkness, challenges the conventional notion of the pastoral.
Jane Fever is a novelist and short story writer based in the Southwest. Her first novel, According to Ruth, was shortlisted for the Authors Club Best First Novel Award and the Dimplex Prize. It was followed by a cycle of linked short stories, Love Me Tender. Her latest novel, An Inventory of Heaven, is set, like the rest of her fiction, in a remote rural community. Jane came to writing relatively late. After working for a dozen years in the poetry department of Faber and Faber, she left London for Devon, where she took over the running of the charity Farms for City Children, set up by Michael Moore Purgo. In 2006, she gave up regular employment to become a freelance writer, editor and teacher, and in 2013, she was appointed as a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Exeter. This podcast focuses on Jane's novel, An Inventory of Heaven. When we first meet the novel's protagonist, the septuagenarian Mavis Gaunt, it is 2006, and Mavis is living a spinster's life in a small house in the Devon village of Shipley, where, it turns out, she was evacuated from London as a child. In present-day Shipley, the mature Mavis finds her routine life disrupted by the arrival of divorcee Eve and her young son, Archie. When Eve begins to question Mavis about the past, Mavis finds herself confronting some uncomfortable and long-buried memories.
So Jane, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about the title. I understand it has something to do with the Irving Berlin song, Dancing Cheek to Cheek, which starts, Heaven, I'm in Heaven. But what or where is heaven exactly?
Well, according to the narrator of the book, who is Mavis Gaunt, it comes from her idea of heaven as a child, which she associates with Devon, so that when she's driving down to Devon with her dad, they sing along in the car, they sing Heaven, I'm in Heaven, but she transposes the word Devon triumphantly because to her, Devon is her idea of heaven. And on a beautiful day, and today is a beautiful day, you know, you can understand completely why the countryside, especially the West Country with its sort of rolling green hills and its deep lanes, is a sort of heavenly, paradisal place.
And does heaven mean anything else to the young Mavis?
I think she has a sense of this heavenly place in the way that poets, or you might be a religious person and has an idea of heaven, or the poets create this idea of a sort of pastoral place that is quintessentially the place they'd like to be, you know, the place without worries, without the place that is a proper home that gives you a sense of home and belonging. Mm. Heaven to her is that place, and the correspondence in the words, the Devon and the heaven and the rhyme in those words, is an easy association for her to make and almost tricks herself into thinking this is the place where she's going to belong.
Yeah, one and the same thing,
yes,
Devon and
exactly.
Devon and
heaven. Yes.
So we've talked a bit about Mavis as a little girl. The story is in fact narrated by Mavis when she's in her 70s. And in the little postscript to the book that makes up the final chapter, we discover that Mavis has written the whole thing, an account of her memories, for one of the younger characters in the book, Eve, who, not wanting to give too much of the story away, has a very particular reason, doesn't she, for wanting to find out about the goings-on in Mavis's childhood. So the book moves between three very particular time frames. We have the 1940s, the 60s, and then the present day, which I think the book opens in 2006. Mm. And it feels quite natural as Mavis recalls different episodes from her past. I'm just wondering if you conceived of the book as a memoir right from the outset, and how you feel about that structural device and the way that it affects the reader as we receive the story.
It's a really interesting question, because I think the thing that I struggle with most, and I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but that structure is the real struggle for me, and finding a structure that actually comes organically out of the material. And I did realise that for this book, I think for a first person narrator, it's much more overt that you actually need to have, you need to be clear as to what the motivation is. What makes someone put pen to paper? If you're an author, then all right, you're an author and you're going to do it. But if you're Mavis, you're 70, you've not had a literary career. Why do you suddenly want to put pen to paper? Why do you want to put it down? So the motivation was important to me, or to find a motivation, to find what is her reason for putting it down. And I think in the end, that's what the book's about. You know, what makes people want to write things down? What's that about?
And I think as readers, looking at it from the other side, it feels very real, receiving the story in that way, seeing snapshots from different periods. It's like listening to somebody recounting their real memories. We don't tell them in strict chronological order. I'm wondering what would differ if the story were told in a straightforward A, B, C, this happened, then that.
It would be a very different sort of control that you'd have to exert on it. And I think that it is all a question of control, and it's a sort of tightrope game. And I think the jumping about in time is something that tests the reader, and you can irritate a reader if you do it too much. You could fall off the wire and then the whole thing's destroyed, really. You can't afford to do that, certainly more than once. I mean, a novel allows you more scope than a poem to fall off the wire and get on again. But actually, if you do it too many times, you've lost your reader. There isn't a point.
Now, as well as moving very deftly, I think, between those three time periods, the story is also set in two contrasting places. We have the Devon village of Shipley, and then we have London, on the other hand, where Mavis's parents live. And as readers, of course, we're bound to draw comparisons between the two and notice contrasts and so on. And in fact, you tell us, or Mavis tells us, very early on in the book, that Shipley actually means shepherd's meadow. You can't get much more pastoral than that. So that seems to be giving the reader a clear clue that the idea of the countryside and the pastoral is important here. And I know you've said before that you're interested in examining the relevance of the pastoral as a location and as a fictional mode. What did you mean by that?
I think I came at it feeling that the pastoral was a sort of neglected thing, or that, you know, that it wasn't sexy. Like the novel is of the city, it's busy, it's the taxi clock's ticking, and the countryside is regarded slightly as sort of a backwater, as boring, as nothing goes on, as sort of untranslatable somehow. So in a perverse way, that's where I wanted to be as a novelist. I think it's much more sympathetic to a poet, the countryside. I think you can sort of carry poems like mice in your pocket and no one questions what you're up to. But I think if you're a novelist, it's quite a hard place to be, unless you're Thomas Hardy. And I think in a way, my way into it was a sort of Hardy way in. I mean, he's incredibly sensitive to what it is about the countryside that makes it different than the city, and how it's very hard to go in and out. If you're a native, that you see enshrined in the landscape the history of the place, that you see the sort of tragedies that have gone on in the copse or the various cottages. I lived very near where this place is, where my novel's set, or sort of pretty much in this village, for about 12 years, which is the blink of an eye in country terms. Obviously in my life is quite a long time. And a long enough to get some sense of the absorption that you need to have, or to know that, for instance, in a vicinity where there's, say, 200 cottages within sort of a few miles, that if you only have to go back about 50 or 60 years and there's a history of suicides in each of those cottages, you know, it's very clear.
Wow.
People who've died, families who've lost people. It's all on the surface, whereas in the city it'd be buried. You know, you wouldn't know if you hardly know who your next door neighbour is. In the countryside, it's right out there. in the countryside, particularly the bit I'm writing about, which Ted Hughes talks about brilliantly, I think, in his the introduction to his collection Moortown Diary, which is set in that little bit of the world. He describes it as being like an island, mm-hmm. because it's got it's bounded by Exmoor, by Dartmoor, by the, he calls them the high wrecking cliffs of the north. It's really preserved in history. It feels like it's about 20 or 30 years behind everywhere else, and quite an isolated community. It's not really on the tourist route. The farms are buried little farms. You're not going to make a great deal of money farming out of that land. So it makes it this very sort of intense, quite isolated place.
And there's a sense in which the sort of countryside that you were describing, the past is very present in a place like that, in a way that it's not perhaps in the city.
I think the thing about the pastoral which encourages this is that it does plumb the depths. You know, it goes right back to prehistory, really. Mm. When we're talking about the pastoral mode, that's what I'm talking about. It's accessing that. And in a city, history's not very long, is it? It's sort of 20 years ago, and it's now, and it goes on. But actually, in a village, you know, the church might be Norman or Saxon, or, and you've got stone circles on the moor, but you have this real sense of these places where monks or farmers or, you know, itinerants walked millennia ago. Mm-hmm.
Now, from what I understand of the pastoral mode as a fictional mode, traditionally country folk are presented as free from complexity and away from the sort of sleaze of city life. And there's very often the suggestion that they're in some sense removed from reality, living a charmed existence. But in your book, that sort of black and white notion of danger in the city is somewhat turned on its head, because the shocking incident at the heart of your book actually occurs right in the heart of the countryside in Shipley and not in London.
Yes, I mean, I think that's a sort of the pastoral misreading of the countryside in a way, or there's a sort of certain strand of the pastoral tradition that willfully misreads the countryside. So, I mean, Alexander Pope talks about how, yes, you've got to be shepherds, but dress them up not as they really are. They've got to be delightful, sweet-smelling shepherds. So there's a whole sort of tradition that has the pastoral as this real idyllic place where nothing smelly or horrid ever goes on. But the reality of the pastoral, I mean, the irony is they exist side by side. There's a sort of paradox, because the reality is that the countryside is an incredibly lonely, isolated pressure cooker of a place. Mm. Everything's very exposed. You're against nature in its most sort of indifferent. The indifference is sort of, is crippling in a way. And it's why all the romantic poets, or forever we've been trying to anthropomorphize the countryside to try and tame it in some way. But actually it's not tameable.
And it's not human.
And it's not human. And it doesn't respond to us, however much we try and make it. It just doesn't. And I think that's a very isolating thing to come to terms with.
Now, An Inventory of Heaven is still drawing in new fans. And I know that Sean O'Brien recently chose it, for instance, as one of his books of the year in the Times Literary Supplement. Now, Sean is perhaps best known as a poet, although he does also write plays, of course. And I noticed that a couple of your sections in the book, so it's divided into chapters, but then also in sections, and these are headed by poem titles, or some of them are. There's William Blake's The Echoing Green and Seamus Heaney's The Underground, for instance. But as well as this, the book is very visually resonant, I think. You might even say poetic, and full of visual imagery, as we'll see. I know that you worked for many years in the poetry department at Faber. I also know that your mother is the poet Vicky Faber. How important is poetry to you? And do you think that yours is the kind of work that might have a particular appeal for poets? Among others, of course.
Well, I'd be very flattered if poets liked it. Poetry was the thing that I first loved in terms of trying to write, actually. And I mean, I think very naively, I did think a poem is a smaller thing, a more possible thing, which was an incredibly naive thing, because actually now I put poets right up on a pedestal, and I think the higher art is poetry. So I sort of scrabbled away a little bit, I think, you know, in my teens, early 20s, thinking I might be able to do that because it's a little thing. I think most of my favourite writers are, in fact, poets. I do love poetry, and I was, as you say, I was very much submerged in that world for quite a few years without actually writing myself, but reading it and admiring it. And I think a lot of it has subliminally crept in without my being even aware of it. I loved the fact that Hardy, as I've said, as a fiction writer is an influence, but I mean also I know as a poet too. There was a funny correspondence where you take ages, it's like naming a child, naming your characters. And so I came up with the name Mavis Gaunt, and the Mavis as a song thrush was quite important to me, and it's an important image in the book. And of course I sought out poems with thrushes in them, and of course there's Hardy's wonderful poem, The Darkling Thrush. And then by complete coincidence, there is the line about the aged thrush who is frail, gaunt and small, which I took to be a sign. it was the right name
from
me.
The darkling thrush.
Yes. Yeah. But anyway, there, the gaunt is there. Obviously, it is associated with that thrush. So there are the little clusters of words. And I think in the same way that poems cluster around, influences cluster around without you even knowing, but you sort of summon them in a way by the images that you choose.
So bird imagery is central to the book, not just thrushes, but birds in general. And at one point, Mavis gets given a thrush in a sort of glass dome, doesn't she?
Yes.
It's quite an important gift.
So it's a bit of taxidermy that she's watched. I mean, taxidermy was quite a common hobby in the countryside at one point. And it does touch on something that the books, I think, you know, it's not really for me to say what it's talking about, but I think this idea of preserving things, how you preserve things, how you memorialise a life, how you remember a life, whether it's worth remembering a life, and in which case how you do it. You might do it in words, you might do it by killing something and then stuffing it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so doing, you know, doing counterintuitive things with it, and maybe writing is that too.
Oh, well, that's, I suppose, how Mavis has preserved this story, the story of her life.
Yes,
and writing
it
her memoir.
Yes.
Now, there's quite a lot of humour in the book. It's not a comic book, or a comical book, I should say, but there's a lot of gentle humour in it. And I'm thinking, for instance, of some of the scenes in the office in London, where the young Mavis is the only member of secretarial staff who's allowed a key to the stationery cupboard. Oh, then there's a scene from her childhood when she comes across a naked male, something she's never seen before, by the riverbank. I wondered if you would read that section in a moment for us. But first, I just want to ask you, I mean, the story itself contains a lot of sadness. Mavis is the child of a very cold and loveless marriage. And then at the heart of the book, there's this awful tragedy that takes place in the middle of winter. I'm wondering if the humour is deliberately there to mitigate the sadness, or what role do you think humour has to play in telling a story of this kind?
I don't think I consciously injected humour. I think partly it's to do with the fact that faced with this sort of implacable countryside, unresponsive, almost at sometimes wasteland, you know, the moor is a very barren place, that humour brings some sort of humanity, that it just is inherent in the human condition, and as in as much as the sadness is. And for me, the two are very, very close. So I think tragicomedy is the sort of most poignant of all sort of forms. And I think that one touches on the other. They come from the same place, really. And I think if you can achieve that knife edge where it could go either way, that's where it's at.
So could you read us a bit from the section where Mavis ventures beyond the entrance to Passiford Farm and on down to the riverbank, and then she comes across something quite unexpected. So she's around 6 or 7 at the time, I think.
Yes. So Mavis has been slightly abandoned by her father and his lover, and off she goes as she spends many of her days on her own, just wandering about. And now she's gone down to the river. I kept going idly because there was no reason to turn back, but I hadn't got much further when I glimpsed something khaki-coloured caught in a bush. My scalp prickled all over. There was a button, an opening, a pocket inside out like a tongue. It was a pair of shorts hanging. I caught a flash of movement and I fell to my knees, heart pounding. I held my breath. Whoever it was had his back to me, a knobbled, skinny spine, the sharp hairline at the base of a neck. It was a boy, squatting, working systematically, examining a patch of ground before frog-jumping sideways onto the next. I don't know how long I sat there watching, locked in, but at some point there was a violent movement just below me, a duck struggling to separate itself from the water. The boy twisted round, my mouth drained. What if he saw me? At the same instant, as if I'd willed it on myself, he rose to his feet, to his full height, and I dropped clumsily back on my heels. He lifted his head, squinting, listening. Then he put his hand to his forehead, shielding his eyes. He was naked as a water baby. I saw the outline handles of his pink ears, the bullet hole of his belly button, and what was below, a rag-end knot of skin.
Yes, yeah, so you really get that sense of her shock coming across that sight suddenly for the first time.
And that excruciating embarrassment at being caught to be watching. I mean, that's the worst thing that you could be caught doing.
Now, Sean O'Brien has made the observation that the book is about, among other things, human kindness, he said. Kindness plays a key part in several of the relationships in the book, doesn't it? And for me, one of the significant relationships, and I also think it's one of the most touching, is the one that exists between 70-year-old Mavis and Eve's little boy, who's eight-year-old Archie. Who gets into the habit of going round to Mavis's house after school.
I'm really pleased that that's been picked up on, because that was something that it was incredibly important to me. I mean, you know, that so often novels are about romantic love, or, you know, that's the epiphanies of romantic love, or the getting together or the not getting together. And actually, I just think love exists in so many other places and in so many smaller ways. And Archie, the young boy, is also integral. And when I was talking about the structure, he's a very important structural element apart from being a character, because he's the person that sort of prompts Mavis's memories too, that she can't help going back in childhood to a boy that she was also very close to at the same age as Archie. So this boy she's met in the river is in some way very reminiscent of Archie. So although they're sort of a long way apart in age, it's that way that people can connect over time, because, of course, we've all been children, and those connections are intense, can be intense, and very fruitful and lovely relationships for people. I mean, renewing relationships for people. So I wanted it to be, you know, poor old Mavis is 70. I didn't want it to be a hopeless, sad story. I wanted there to be hope for her. And I think Archie does bring that. And it's a very tiny, touching sort of love, but it's no less huge than any other sort of love, I think, in the end.
Several particular images have stayed with me from the book. And one of them that sticks most in my mind is of the young Mavis in her bedroom, when she first goes back to London and her mother is unable to hold her, isn't she?
Yes, I mean, the mother's an odd character. She's French. And she was sort of plucked from Paris far too young by a youthful, the father, who goes over to sow his wild oats and sows them a bit too frenetically and comes back with this bride who can't really speak English. He very quickly loses interest in her, and she's sort of landed in London. She's got no network. She's got no one. She's not the brightest woman. She's got no inner resources, really. And she's got this child. Mm-hmm. And then the war comes and the child goes away. So then there's years when they don't see each other, literally years. And so she doesn't really have a connection or a bond with the child. The husband's left her slightly high and dry.
So I'd love to discuss this this particular scene then, when Mavis does go back when she's 7 years old. Perhaps I could hear you read an extract of that. I'll just give a bit of context to this. So it's the summer of 1943, and Mavis is seven, I think.
Yes, that sounds right.
And her father has collected her from Shipley to take her back to London. So the pair of them arrive home, and it's the middle of the night. And Mavis's mother, who's French, as you say, takes her up to bed. And then we'll hear that section.
Mother moved with small, deliberate steps. The stairs were dimly lit. There was a huge piece of blackout, the long length of a window tacked between the two landings. I followed her up along another corridor where she pointed out the bathroom and into a room at the far end. Mother leaned over to click on a bedside lamp. There was a wooden bed, a cupboard in the corner, a rug on the floor, as if someone already lived there. Then I saw lying at the end of the bed a doll with a beautiful white dress, a flat, circular straw hat, her eyes shut. "Alors," Mother said, and she went over and turned back the embroidered counterpane, tugged at the sheets. I stood in my shoes and then I reached out and picked up the doll, and as I did, her thick eyelashes tipped open, a pair of speckled conker eyes. "Is a present," Mother said, and she trembled as I tipped the doll backwards and forwards. She was beautiful. Her face shone in the lamplight, heart-shaped and rosy. She had tiny ruby lips and the blackest hair curled down to her shoulders. Her two brown eyebrows were painted high and in crescents, just like Mother's. Mother watched me as I touched the gauzy material of the skirt, its tiny green polka dots, the matching satin bow across her chest. Underneath she had frilly petticoats and knickerbockers, lacy white ankle socks and white leather boots. I'd never held anything so precious. "Sleep, yes," Mother said. She leaned towards me, her breath smelling of ash. "You can turn out the light?" I didn't want her to go. As soon as she left, the room hollowed out. I fumbled at my shoes, undid the buckles and slipped them off, then climbed into the bed in all my clothes, posting myself between the icy sheets, pulling the doll towards me carefully by her crooked arms. The tag on her dress said Scarlet, but I was going to call her Frances, I decided, because I wanted to name her myself. I reached out and clicked off the lamp and then lay there, hardly daring to breathe. "Frances," I whispered to her. My voice blew a hole in the blackness. Both of us lay stiff and rigid. All I could remember from the lamplight was the pattern on the curtains, parasols upside down and floating now like dandelion seed all around the room.
So I think that image of the dandelion seed is just so resonant, and it echoes long after you've finished reading it. What's extraordinary about that scene is the complete lack of physical contact between the mother and the daughter. And she gives this beautiful doll present, and the way that she trembles as Mavis tips it forward and backwards.
Yes, I think her daughter to her is almost another a creature that she just doesn't know how to relate to. And the same goes for Mavis. I mean, her mother's just this sort of, she's had a photograph of her, a sort of touched up photograph, and the reality is something totally different. There's got to be some whole new way of negotiating.
Their ideas of each other are not quite real, are they?
No.
So that when they meet, there is no real meeting.
No.
And you also said that you're interested in exploring the play between the metaphoric and the literal. I wonder if that's what we're seeing to a degree in this bedtime scene. Is this an example of that? I mean, the bedroom at that point seems full of these different objects that seem loaded with meaning.
Yes, I mean, that ties back in a way to the title and where that title came from, an inventory. I think I originally conceived the book as being a sort of telling a life through the objects of a life. So I have the father's umbrella, I have things that have belonged to the aunt, I have a little mute on a violin. And in the end, that became too schematic and they got absorbed. But I think it's that idea of, yes, how do you tell a life? How do you memorialise? How do you remember what's gone on? Is it just by the objects that people leave? I mean, like a sort of great museum of a life, or is it the memories that are embedded and passed on in a family? But I mean, if there's no family, if there's to pass things on, then I think there's more of an urgency about how you get remembered. So it's to do with that, and then how you represent that in language. And I'm very interested in metaphor and how metaphor, once you set a metaphor up, how it does its own work, you know, how then you're not responsible for it anymore. It does its own stuff. And I mean, as a poet, that's what presumably like you're doing the whole time.
Dropping a stone in the water and
yes,
then watching
and
the
then
ring.
Watching. And then it has its own energy, and it's nothing to do with your energy at all. It's a living thing, I think. And that's what Ted Hughes is talking about as well in sort of his poems, where he's capturing animals, and that you can't maim them, you can't be too fussy about them, you've got to let them have their life and let them go and let them be separate.
Which is a great thing, because then you yourself can move on from it, but also a scary thing, them having a life of their own.
Yes.
And being read differently from, you know.
Yes, yes, you can't control how they're going to be read, and you've got to just trust that they're strong enough to stand up to the whatever way they're going to be read or interpreted.
Well, I think your book certainly is strong enough to stand up to that. And thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Julia.
Novelist and short story writer Jane Fever. An Inventory of Heaven is published by Corsair.
That was Jane Fever in conversation with Julia Copus. You can find out more about Jane on the RLF website, Her surname is spelt F-E-A-V-E-R. And that concludes episode 69, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 70, RLF writers explore the ethical minefields of writing from real life in The Splinter of Ice. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.